This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 30th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're asking what gets washed up. To answer that poser, we'll get our waders on and head to the estuary. We'll go mudlarking with a Thames fancier. We'll be in Rio to judge a city by its driftwood. And we'll ask what happens to all the Lego and Nike sneakers that fall off container ships. Obviously. It's flotsam versus jetsam. It's one man's muck is another man's brass. It's all to come here on Culture on Monocle 24. Today we're asking what gets washed up, although our first interviewee argues that we should be asking what gets washed out. Nick Stevens is a mudlark, he who goes plunging into the Thames mud to search for treasure. Why and what has he found?
Obviously, London's been here for a long time. Nowadays we have rubbish collection a couple of days a week. Before that existed, what would you do with all your rubbish? You would just go chuck it somewhere. So you'd throw it somewhere where it was kind of out of sight, out of mind. Yeah. That's essentially what we're finding. We're finding the rubbish that Londoners have been chucking into the river since London began.
So one man's muck is another man's brass.
Absolutely.
Quite literally. And you've brought some stuff along. Tell us about mudlarking. People will think that this is a type of bird. Maybe it is. Maybe it's something.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe it's something with a spoonbill and long legs that runs in and out of the Thames, the tide of the Thames. But tell us about it. Tell us where it started. Maybe tell us how it started for you as well.
Well, the actual term mudlarking goes back, I think, probably to as far back as about the 17th century, I think. And it was a term to describe essentially urchins, young kids, who would go down to the River Thames, down to the banks of the mud, banks of the River Thames, into that mud and find anything that they could get their hands on to sell, to earn a few pennies so they could live, essentially. So that term was given to those young children all those years ago.
My favourite phrase to take away, actually, from your website is the fact that the Thames Museum is the place where history changes twice a day.
Exactly.
It's a lovely idea, actually. It's a lovely way that the tide sort of affects us all, but it particularly affects what can be washed up or washed out.
Washed out, yes.
Before Nick Stevens gives me the evil eye there. Where on earth should we go first? Which century are we going? Are we going 20th century? How far back can we go?
Well, we could go back as far back as possible. In terms of man-made finds, I have here a Mesolithic stone hand axe.
Wow, so we've really gone, okay.
Yeah, well, this is obviously my oldest handmade find. It's about 10,500 years old.
Oh, I thought that was something that people at Millwall carried in their back pockets.
Well, they maybe still do, I don't know, but yeah. When I found this, you know, I almost fell over in the mud, just, oh my God, this has been on my hit list for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And instantly when I saw it, I knew exactly what it was. But this particular style is called a Thames pick because this style is only found in the Thames Valley. So we know this belonged to a Londoner.
Right. Date that for us again.
10,500 years old. It's Mesolithic.
That is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
This is presumably when London was nothing but a collection of huts on the side of the Thames.
But people came here because of the layout and the geography.
I mean, you must be experienced at reading the tides and all the rest of it, knowing, you know,
absolutely,
you have a little chart, or do you know by instinct nowadays?
No, I know sort of roughly. It's all based on moon cycles, essentially. So each month you get lower tides and higher tides. We've just gone through, I guess, some lunar cycle where the tides have been exceptionally low. So
you've had field days.
I had 8 Roman coins in 2 days, 3 on one day, 5 on the next day, which is not a bad game. Pretty pleased with that.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Talking of coins, you've got some here in plastic pouches, and we did talk about these before you started off, but you're gonna have to redo your spiel on these, because they're not just any old coins.
They are not just any old coins. These are called 17th century traders' tokens. So you're going to go back to the 17th century when basically there wasn't enough small change to go round. So let's say you're a baker and you're selling your loaves of bread for half a penny. But there are no half penny coins. There are only penny coins. So you somehow need to give change to your customer. And there just aren't enough to go around. So what are you going to do? So you're going to make your own, essentially. And the government just kind of turned a blind eye to this. They allowed it to happen because they knew there was nothing they could kind of do about it. And, well, it's helping the economy by keeping these industries going.
Yeah.
So what's great about them is that they have so much information to tell us. I have quite a few of these in my collection. I've got about 30 odd, but the ones I've got in front of me here are so interesting because these all come from where the Great Fire of London happened. I've got one here with from Pudding Lane, which...
This is the epicenter.
Exactly, but it's a kind of a bit of a misconception that we all think that Pudding Lane, we know that Mr. Farriner, the baker, you know, yeah. That's where the fire started. So we think, well, he was a baker, so maybe he must have made puddings. That's what it's called, Pudding Lane. It's not. It's actually P-U-D-I-N, pudding, which is the medieval term for offal. Because just above Pudding Lane was the slaughterhouses. So they used to come down that street with wheelbarrows full of offal on the way down to the Thames and just dump it into the river. So after a while, they just thought it's kind of offal lane. They call it offal lane.
But the medieval That's a brilliant fact. I actually genuinely never knew that either. That's a brilliant fact.
There we go.
You said that these coins, for example, the baker on Pudding Lane, would have had his own, not necessarily coat of arms, but he would have said, you know, Mr. Baker and Sons, the baker, and it would have been on his coin and his coin alone.
Exactly. This guy... it just says actually Brian Appleby was this chap's name. He was a vintner, so he sold wine and beer essentially. So he'd have been a couple of doors down from our baker who did what he did or didn't do rather.
It's fascinating stuff. When you're finding these things, I mean, it's making me paint a picture in my mind of what this must have been like at the time. Is that why you do it? Is that the attraction that it sort of makes?
It does.
It does make, you know, it's such a cliche, but it makes history come alive. It kind of makes you want to read further.
It does. It does, which is another reason why we want to do our museum, because it's hands on history. And we do quite a lot of events in the summer with members of the public, and it's the kids. It's to see that interest spark in their eyes, and to be able to hold a piece of history in their hands. Mm. And that, for me, that's how it happened for me as a kid to have found that item and realise what it is, and that's where the imagination just gets fired off. And
keeping stuff at arm's length keeps your imagination at arm's length.
It does, yeah. So to actually go out, you know, again, we do these events and we're actually in the mud with these kids, and they're able to sort of find stuff themselves. What is this? What is that? And once you tell them, it's just
that's My Little Pony. It's not really worth it. We've got a couple more really wonderful looking items here. What's this long?
This type pair of scissors. Okay, it's very strange. It's got sort of scooped ends to these scissors. And I thought, well, is it for cutting a wick of a candle? But I don't know, something odd about it. So I did a bit of research, and then I just thought, well, that would kind of fit a ball. And I thought, musket ball tweezers. And when I did some research, it's exactly what it is. This would have belonged to a ship surgeon on board a ship. In combat, someone gets a musket ball inside them, and that's how you get rid of it.
Man, that's seen some action then.
That has seen some action, yeah.
We're going to end your collection with a bit of a sound effect.
A bit of a sound bite, yeah.
This is a beautiful little bell that you found. Give it a ring and tell us what that is.
So you can all hear that. This is called a crotal bell. So this would have been worn around the neck of the lead animal of a flock of sheep or cattle or goats, whatever. This would have been a sound that you'd have heard the whole time in London. Go back sort of 200-300 years, no cars. Don't forget, you know, you don't think we've got fields in London, but again, go back a couple of hundred years, that we'd have been surrounded by fields and pasture land. The city was built around it. So when I found this, it was all caked in mud, and I thought, I'm going to go and have some fun here. So I took it down to the river, I gave it a washout, and then I was able to make that noise. And I thought to myself, that noise has not been heard for about 250-300 years.
That was Nick Stevens, and if you want to find out more about his upcoming Thames Museum, head to thamesmuseum.org. Well, Nick's mudlarking finds paint a fascinating picture of London's history. There are other items found on the shore that don't give us quite the same glimpse into the past, but do provide glorious snapshots into the minds of people sitting on riverbanks, at the ends of piers, and on clifftops the world over. Messages in bottles are beguiling objects. They contain love letters, confessions, notes to those who have passed, photographs, hopes, and dreams. Nicola White is a mudlark who spends her weekends trawling the River Thames estuaries. Over the past few years, she's found over 50 messages in bottles and endeavoured to make contact with the authors, often with successful results. Culture producer Holly Fisher met up with Nicola on a windy Saturday afternoon to go hunting for notes from afar along the shores of Higham in Kent. But first, she joins Nicola in her studio to read through some of her finds.
The first one was by accident. It was my dog who found it, came bounding along with a plastic bottle with a little note in it. And after that, I started actively looking for them.
You've got a folder in front of you now with all your messages in. Perhaps you could talk us through a few of those and some of the people that you've come across.
Well, I've got a huge mixture of messages. I think one of my favourite ones has got to be, "I wish I could be a Dino Thunder Power Ranger." The Red Ranger from Jack Hodges. He didn't have any contact details on it at all, just his name. But through Twitter, we did manage to trace this boy, and we sent him a Power Ranger outfit, and he was absolutely thrilled with that. And he wrote back to us with a picture of him in his Power Ranger outfit. I found another one here, actually, which is in the bottle recently, which I love, because some of the messages are in plastic bottles, which is all well and good, but to be honest, it's nicer to find them in glass bottles because it's more ecologically friendly. But this one, which is very pleasant, says, "My name is Georgie Manor, England, East London, age 50. Whoever finds this bottle, well done. This will bring you good luck and happiness." And then he gives a phone number. So I contacted the number, and eventually I heard back, and it turned out that this person was an ex-armed robber in prison whose friend had thrown this in the river, and he wanted to put something good back into the world. And I had an interesting chat with him. As far as I know, he's still in prison. But I have had lots of good luck and happiness, so...
Thank you, Georgie. I like how he, on the back of that, put an address of message in a bottle.
Yeah. Message in a bottle, message in a bottle. Okay, well, we're near Higham, right next to the Thames estuary. It's quite a remote place. You don't see too many people here. And there's been some very high tides recently, so there's a lot of debris washed up amongst... the debris are a lot of bottles, and so it's the sort of place where if you're lucky you might stumble across a message in a bottle. You get a lot of red herrings, food wrappers in bottles. You get that excited feeling and then you pick it up and it's a crisp packet.
Are there normally certain spots where you find certain things?
Yeah, no, particularly along the sea wall and in the little nooks and crannies where things tend to accumulate.
So we're looking in the corners?
Yes.
We were talking before we turned the microphone on a little bit about some of these messages, and some of them are quite funny and some of them are quite personal. How do you choose which ones you keep and you investigate and which ones you throw back in the water?
If a message is particularly personal, for example, a month or so ago, I found a message in a bottle which was obviously written by a family to a member of their family who had died recently. And I read it and I thought, no, that needs to carry on its journey along the river. So I put it back in the bottle and sent it on its way. I think you need to have due respect for people's feelings, and some things just aren't appropriate to share. You know, it's private.
What's the furthest place you've ever had one come from?
I found a lovely message that was written in 2007 by a Swedish family that was celebrating their brother's 40th birthday. And they asked whoever found the bottle to please send a happy birthday message to their brother. And of course, by the time I found it, he would have been 48, I suppose. And I did contact them, and she was quite emotional that I'd found this bottle after such a lot of time.
Do you find you get many emotional responses? Because you throw these things in the water thinking, you know, it would be nice if someone found it, but what are the chances? There must be so many thousands of messages in bottles in the sea
that don't get found. Yeah, absolutely. I've got one here. It's from a little girl called Neve, and it was almost falling apart when I found it in the bottle. It's lucky that I could actually read it, but she drew a little picture when she was 3 years old. And so she, when I found it, that was 11 years previously that she'd thrown it in. And she, I think, found it quite, special, seeing something that she'd done all that time ago and probably completely forgotten about it.
Oh, someone's vouchers.
Yeah.
Vouchers in a bottle.
Vouchers in a bottle.
And a feather.
And a feather in a bottle. It's another wrapper in a bottle.
Having a little red herring today.
If you're going to write a message in a bottle, do write it in pencil. I mean, this is a good example. You see, I can't really read that, although it says something like, "Please help me, I am stranded on a desert island." But unfortunately, I can't read which one because the ink tends to be bleached by the sun over the years. So I have found messages with nothing on them whatsoever. And you think, oh, that's such a shame. So I would say a good glass bottle with a very tight-fitting cork written in pencil, and there you are, you're away. I think there's something symbolic about throwing a message in a bottle in the water, because you're letting go of something, whether it's feelings or emotions. I mean, that's how I look at it. I think you're letting go, and then you have to leave the outcome, really, and see what happens.
Lots of bottles, but so far,
no messages.
So we've just got back into the car after going mudlarking. We did find a few things today. What did we find today, Nicola?
Well, we found a couple of clay pipes, probably from the 18th century. We found a very nice, or rather you found a very nice, Hindu plastic bottle in the shape of Vishnu, which I imagine was thrown in the river as an offering. Oh, and a few lost toys as well, which I always like finding lost toys. Unfortunately, we didn't find any messages in bottles.
Have you ever thrown your own messages in bottles into the sea?
Yes, I have. I tend to do that when I visit another country. I'll throw a couple of messages in bottles in. I've done that in Greece and in India, and indeed in Guernsey when I was there a few months ago. I've also thrown a few in over here. It's interesting to wonder who's going to find them and if they're going to get back to you.
And have you had any replies yet?
So far, I have had a couple of replies, yes, from one that I threw in Greece. A couple of little young Greek girls found it, so they contacted me. And also one that I threw in here. Somebody contacted me to say that they'd found it, because I'd said whoever finds this bottle will win a little fish made of collected glass by the river. So they rang up to claim their prize.
That was Mudlark and Nicola White with Culture's Own wannabe mudlark Holly Fisher. And to see her finds or help her locate the authors of her messages in bottles, head to tidelineart.com. Now, in that last report, you'll have heard Holly crunching her way through hundreds of bottles, although there's sometimes treasure to be found amongst them. Our next story talks about the environmental impact. In Rio de Janeiro, cleanliness of the Guanabara Bay is a hot issue. It will be the official Olympic venue for sailing in 2016, but it's also known to be incredibly polluted, with items such as toilet bowls, sofas, and even dead animals floating in its waters. One activist, Fernanda Cortez, has curated an exhibition named Objects Found in Guanabara Bay, the presence the bay never wanted to get. It's made art out of items found in the bay and puts a price on each to show how much it would cost to fish it out. Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter visits the exhibition and tells us what's been found in the city's waters.
Soothing sounds of the piano fill the air at the upscale Shopping Leblon, Rio de Janeiro South Zone, making for a pleasant shopping experience. But smack dab in the middle of the shopping center, it's hard to miss what looks like part of a transplanted landfill. Moldy old car tires, swollen wet and nearly disintegrated old wooden doors, and even old bar chairs sit out in the open and stand out like a sore thumb in the swanky mall. Really, it's a unique art exhibition. Objects found in Guanabara Bay, the presence the bay never wanted to get, with all of these items having been pulled out of Rio's famous bay. Fernando Cortez, the curator and activist behind the exhibition, explains why she created this project.
When we were thinking about how the Olympics are coming and the Bahia de Guanabara is so important because that's where some competitions will happen. Mainly what we see in the news and everything is how the government is not doing their part on preventing the Bahia de Guanabara to be like that, like a whole big trash disposable place. We would like to change a little bit what people think about that, because there's a very important part that's the citizen and how people can contribute for that to be better or worse.
One doesn't have to go far from Shopping Leblanc to see Guanabara Bay's pollution problem. Not far from the city's international airport on Ilha do Fundão, mounds of garbage crunch and crinkle under the weight of water biologist Mario Massoletti's feet as he walks along the riverbank. a place where the smell is nearly unbearable. Even though the government has poured around 400 million US dollars into cleaning up the bay in time for the Rio 2016 Olympics, it's not enough. This is just the visible garbage. It's estimated that about 345 Olympic-sized swimming pools of sewage are dumped into Guanabara Bay every day. And according to Mario Massoletti, there is a lack of willingness to clean up the bay.
Bom, o programa de despoluição da Baía de Guanabara.
There was an estimate that it would have cost 1.8 billion US dollars over the last 20 years. The result, which was promised by the authorities, simply wasn't delivered. The environmental quality of the Guanabara Bay is now very compromised. Water treatment plants are only operating at half their capacity because water treatment to treat all of this rubbish doesn't exist for the plant to operate at full capacity. Because of this, all the rivers that go to Guanabara Bay are contaminating it. I would like to invite the Brazilian authorities to come and get to know Guanabara Bay, because, unfortunately, most of the time, the data that is passed along by PRs doesn't reflect the chaotic reality of it.
And with less than 500 days to go until the start of the Rio 2016 Games, Mario isn't optimistic about Guanabara Bay getting cleaned up.
No atual caso,
actually, it's a disaster. You don't have any control over the water residue. You don't have any control over the sewage system. So it's Russian roulette. If the current eco-barriers were swapped for efficient eco-barriers, and if the cleanup was done mechanically, you would have a reduction in the solid residue, and it would clean up the areas that are impacted by it. So this problem could be improved. In terms of the sewage, unfortunately, I don't have any hope.
Back over at the exhibition at Shopping Leblanc, not everyone sees the message that Fernando Cortes is trying to portray.
Lixo recolhido.
For 80-year-old Fernando Salimão, the exhibition is nothing more than garbage passing itself off as art. He says that the exhibition is just showing off trash and making it look like decoration. It doesn't make sense, he says, and that finding items like an old door in the bay is normal. Even though the concept of the exhibition isn't clear to everyone who's come to see it, Fernando Cortes is convinced she can help make Guanabara Bay less polluted through her activism art, and that Rio de Janeiro can have a clean bay if cariocas make a conscious effort to keep it that way.
It can be done. Sometimes the damage is so big that it can't be done. Restoring it, it's impossible. So how can we prevent that from happening?
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
What are you doing in my waters?
Thanks, Sheena. Now, to round things off, we're going to get a little bit scientific. Curtis Ebersmeyer is an American oceanographer who spent much of his retirement studying flotsam. That's items that have fallen off ships or even bits of shipwreck floating in the sea. Crates containing millions of pieces of Lego and hundreds of shoes and even thousands of rubber ducks have fallen off cargo ships in the past. And although this isn't great for the environment, it does help scientists like Ebersmeyer to trace the ocean's movements. He speaks to producer Holly down the line from Seattle.
I get reports from beachcombers worldwide, and I've put out a newsletter called the Beachcomber Alert, and I report back to beachcombers what to look for. It's the only way that I have of interrogating beachcombers to find out what the ocean's really doing, because it's not a scientific discipline. So it's sort of like George Gallup starting out in the 1920s saying, well, I'm going to interrogate the public to see what they think, and it wasn't a scientific discipline. But now it is, and it's kind of like a social network of thousands of beachcombers. So you get to put your finger on the pulse of the ocean.
And what do finding these things and their locations tell you about the ocean?
Well, a lot of it's telling me that the Arctic Ocean is melting much more quickly than we think. We're getting things that go across the Arctic Ocean fairly frequently now. Things that start over in Alaska and wind up in Britain aren't unusual anymore. And it's surprising that something released at the North Pole in 33 months can be over in Britain. I think the flotsam is telling us that there's not as much ice there to hold flotsam back in the Arctic.
And is that where a lot of these things end up, in the Arctic?
Some do. It's just one place to keep track of. the Pacific Ocean, we got a lot of debris from the Japanese tsunami. It's still washing up right at the anniversary mark, 3 years later. I expect it to be washing up for 60 years.
And what's the strangest location something's turned up in? I suppose you kind of have a general idea of where things will go. Do you still get surprised?
Well, yes, it's very surprising. It takes 25 years to go around the planet. And it's not unusual now to find something that goes entirely around the northern hemisphere in about, I'd say, 8 to 25 years. So the ocean is surprisingly quick. And I'm continually amazed at how sort of tidy, how she collects things. About 90% of all the flotsam washes up on just 10% of the shoreline. So if you know where to clean up the beaches, you go to these particularly dirty places and clean them up, and that's the best use of people's time.
Do you keep the things that you find? Do you have a collection of weird and wonderful items from the sea in your living room, perhaps?
Well, in my basement is about 3,000 square feet, and it is pretty well packed with things and stories. And my wife likes to keep me down below deck here, so everything I do about the ocean's down below deck.
And what do your findings get used for? How is this information put into practice?
Well, back in the early 90s, when I published Flotsammetrics, I drew attention to plastic in the ocean, and that's been a theme that's been picked up on. So I'm pretty happy that I've started some things. So plastic could spell the end of humanity if you want to go that direction, but it's one of the nastiest forms of pollution, and it makes climate change seem like child's play.
I've also read all your findings. I also get used to help track people that are lost at sea and how long they'll take to get back.
Yeah, people call me once or twice a year saying that they lost their yacht and can I help find it. Sometimes people call me and say, my friend fell overboard, where is the body? One time a cook fell overboard in the Bering Sea and we found his jawbone 3 or 4 years later in a fox den. Another time a fellow fell off of another fishing vessel and we found his remains in a bear's den.
Do you find these things miles and miles and miles away from where they happened?
Yes, very often it's hundreds, if not thousands of miles.
And what's the strangest place this work's ever taken you?
Oh, strangest places, they're all interesting. I don't think there's any strange place to me. The strangeness comes through some of the stories, like the skeleton in a survival suit and a complete skeleton washed up 2 years after the gentleman went overboard, and we still don't know his name. Because of the story, I went to where he was found on the northeast shore of Oahu, and it's not a particularly strange place. A jogger was jogging along and saw a blue survival suit and stopped, and there was a skull staring at the runner out through the face hole. So
that's a pretty terrifying run.
Yes. So sometimes it's an ordinary place with a very bizarre piece of flotsam. So you don't have to go to strange places to find interesting things.
That was oceanographer Curtis Ebersmeyer. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is us answering the question that we asked 28 minutes ago. What gets washed up? Any old junk, isn't it? Or is it? No, there's gold in those that are beaches and mudflats. And what is more, what gets washed up is more or less stories. We hope your interest has been piqued by those of our guests. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly Fisher, a freshly minted coin if ever there was one. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.